Missing this?
When that didn't materialise, I think both Paulie and myself probably looked at each other and kind of thought, what next?
Then get this, the all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home, featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis, plus almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free and ready when you are, at home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play.
The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.
The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power.
We love the beautiful game more than Olivia Giroud loves the near post.
Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well, do it then.
Country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Welcome back. Time for the Football Show. A little bit later on this hour, we'll be joined by former Republic of Ireland captain Kenny Cunningham to take a look at the Europa League and Champions League action, which is coming up this weekend. Manchester United already into the last eight of the Europa League with their victory against LASK 7-1 on aggregate, 2-1 last night at Old Trafford. They will play FC Copenhagen on Monday in Cologne. Wolves are looking to join Manchester United in the last eight on that side of the draw, and they're 1-0 up early in the second half against Olympiacos. The goal coming from Raul Jimenez in the 10th minute from the penalty spot. Basel also on course to reach the last eight, 0-0 currently against Eintracht Frankfurt, but Basel are 3-0 up from the first leg of that tie. Steven Gerrard's Rangers, the road ran out for them, losing away from home tonight to Bayer Leverkusen by 1-0, and they've lost 4-1 on aggregate. And Sevilla in the one-off tie against Roma to qualify for the last eight, the Spanish side have won there by 2-0. So we'll talk about that with Kenny. We'll talk about the Champions League, including Man City's game against Real Madrid tomorrow. Gareth Bale refusing to travel with Real Madrid is the news from the Madrid camp tonight. He's not with Zinedine Zidane's team. It was initially suspected that he had been left out, but Zidane has said that Bale refused to travel, and it's now expected that Gareth Bale will leave Real Madrid in the coming weeks. But only one story in football really over the last 24 hours, and that's been the latest goings on in the FAI. This morning, the Fianna Fáil TD Mark McSharry was on OTBAM. He claimed that there's been a level of grubbiness about the governance of the FAI in recent months. His comments follow eight members of the current board claiming that they hadn't approved a memorandum of understanding with the government before the association signed off on it in January. Those elected members have now called on interim CEO Gary Owens to clarify what he said about the issue at a press conference yesterday afternoon. On OTBM this morning, McSharry said ratifying the proposals, which would see six independent seats on the board, would make the FAI an outlier in world sport.
I have no issue who is on the board, but I think the sport that's represented by this board should have a majority of people from that sport on it. Who the personalities are, I have no interest once there's an appropriate process to put them in place. What we have done is retro-engineer the board now to facilitate what, coincidentally, a number of whom were involved in a different group altogether, and that's fine. They may be the very best people for the job, as I said in the record at the door. The process that has taken place in terms of signing the MOU, in terms of other relationships to do with the board, and recruitment that have taken place over the last 6 months, does not stand up to basic corporate governance principles. I've shown that at the door, and I have no issue with anybody challenging my view on it. In terms of my sources, as I said, my own sources included two people on the board and about 26 other people involved, from pitch markers and jersey washers right up along. So like you, and I think at the very outset I said, we all want to see our football federation renewed and operating to the highest standard of governance and promoting the game at all levels. We're all on the same page on that one. I'm just not on the same page in how we've dealt with it over the last 6 months, which unfortunately bears a level of grubbiness that doesn't quite match the mistakes of the past, but doesn't augur well and doesn't sit well with me.
Comparing them to the mistakes of the past where the debts are 50 million. I said it wasn't quite as grubby.
Now, the other thing
it wasn't quite as grubby. It's a scale of grubbiness. And I think that's the impression that you're trying to leave in people's minds.
The other thing, no, I'm not trying to leave anything in the people's minds. I'm just telling you what I feel.
Okay, that was Fianna Fáil TD for Sligo Leitrim, Mark McSherry. We speak on OTB AM, our show in the breakfast each morning, with thanks to Gillette. Now, there has been a statement this evening from the FAI chairperson, Roy Barrett. We heard from Richie on the news round about it. He insists all board members were aware of the terms of the memorandum of understanding between the association and the government. In a statement this evening, he says he had no hesitation in signing off on that memorandum back in January. A special FAI council meeting will be held tomorrow, and an EGM will follow at the end of this month. Now, to talk about all this, we're joined on the line by the Daily Mail's Philip Quinn. Philip, good evening to you.
Good evening, Will.
It's become quite interesting over the last while. I mean, we've had quite a bit of back and forth. We had Owens and Quinn speaking yesterday. Then we had that late night statement, which maybe felt like the old FAI regime in many ways, coming out at 11 p.m. And now we've had Roy Barrett coming back this evening with a statement of his own.
Yeah, and Mark McSherry has just come out with another statement since then. I mean, the statement's hitting, they're going to and fro like a Borg McEnroe volley at Wimbledon back in the good old days. You know what, I'm on this gig a long time, Will, and I kind of thought we were beyond this, I'll be honest with you. I kind of thought after the 1996 Night of the Long Knives in Westbury, when a number of these FBI officers resigned, one or two were persuaded to go back again. Others were voted out. I kind of thought that the FAI would sort of patch itself up after that. Then we had 2002 Genesis report. I thought we were going to patch ourselves up after that. When I say ourselves, I mean everybody in Irish football. And you know, we've just got over, or we're trying to get over, the wretched regime that was that of John Delaney's tenure as CEO. And the FAI just can't seem to sort of move on and get themselves into a better place. Now, I will say, and you have to just, you know, at the onset, you have to establish that the people who came in, and this is board members and also the Roy Barrett and Gary Owens and Niall Quinn, they inherited an unholy mess. You know, the association was absolutely on its knees. It was about to close shop, and they had to get a deal done. And having got a deal done, there was no football. There's been no income. There's been nothing from the international team. There's been no sponsorship announced. So the sport is in a bad place. We've just got it back going again last week. A bit of good news on the League of Ireland front. Matches have been played, albeit the Waterford COVID-19 issue is a cloud. But we've got football playing again. But there's still no money coming in from the FAI. And unless this memorandum of understanding is the reforms that are attached to it, unless it's passed, there will be no more money. And talking to Gary Owens yesterday at the FAI, I think it's about 35, 37 million hinging on signing on these reforms getting passed, and they can only get passed at an EGM. So there's a lot at stake. I think at the moment what you're seeing is people positioning themselves. Yeah. We've had Roy Barrett coming out yesterday, and you say Mark McSherry, who's an outsider, but he's making observations. You've had the board are clearly split, and then you have the council members who have called this meeting. These are the rank and file people, men and women who represent the affiliates association, that represent the volunteers bodies. 90% of Irish football people are volunteers. They're drawn from all aspects of the game, and they're the ones who've called this meeting tomorrow, and they want answers, and they want answers from Barrett, and they want clear and unambiguous answers. Otherwise, they have the power to eliminate or ask anybody on the board to go. They can vote them off, and that would include Roy Barrett, that would include the president, the vice president. They can vote anybody off they want if they choose to do so. So we have a high-stakes meeting tomorrow in the Red Cow Hotel. High stakes, indeed.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately the stakes here, as you mentioned, potentially around €30 million on the line, definitely the €18 million bailout. And at least at that press conference yesterday afternoon, Gary Owens made it fairly clear. He said, it's not pretty, the alternative, if this doesn't get passed at the EGM. And I get the feeling, Philip, that the government aren't going to go back to the negotiating table here. They'll say that an agreement was signed back in January in good faith, and you have to meet the terms of this agreement or the money won't flow.
I think that is the stance, and I think that'll be the message conveyed by Roy Barrett tomorrow at the council meeting. I think it'll be, this is a deal the FAI really can't afford to pass up on. But it doesn't take away from other issues that need to be urgently addressed. And if I can just bring up one there, if I may. Mm-hmm. Roy Barrett put a statement out tonight in which he said that he was given the terms of the memorandum in January at around 8 o'clock the day before it was signed. This wasn't passed on until to other board members until 9 o'clock the next morning. Now, why weren't they given the MOU at 8 o'clock the night before with a sort of, you know, a condition. Read this, gentlemen and ladies, and we'll have a Zoom conference tomorrow at 7 o'clock and see what you think. They got it at 9:02. They didn't have time to digest it. They saw one or two things they didn't like, particularly the six versus six, or six and six, depending on what way you want to say it, and also the call of the council members at more than 10 years service. But their backs were to the wall. They had no wriggle room, so they said, yeah, okay, let's sign it. Mm. And Barrett did sign it, and Owens presented it. Barrett and Owens and Niall Quinn were the faces at Gleeson Lane that day, you know, and there was it was peace in our time, and they got the deal over the line, and everyone thought at the time it was a good deal, but there were people a little bit unhappy about the optics. There was nobody there for example, the football family. There was no president there. There's no vice president. You know, why weren't they there? And also the fact that the board members hadn't a chance to digest it. And look, in the last 6-7 months, you know, we've had lots of time to think about other things, because football has been in cold storage, COVID-19 storage, and people are looking at the small detail of the MOU, and they're wondering, is there a bit of wriggle room? And I think there is. I think there is. You know, the 6-v-6 with Roy Barrett as chairman having the casting vote, there's an easy way around that. That can be changed at an AGM by just making the president, Gerry McInerney, having the casting vote, which would keep football people having the final say on matters at the table of the FAI. But there's still a problem, because two directors from the football side would have to go, and that's something that the board of directors are not happy with, and they also kind of feel they haven't probably been kept entirely in the loop with all that's been going on in the last few months. So look, there's some explaining to do, and I will say one other thing. I mean, I've spoken to Roy Barrett several times in the last few months. You know, he probably hasn't reached out to other people in the FAI that maybe he possibly should have. You know, he's not very well known. I mean, he has a day job with good buddies. It's an important job, but he is someone that people haven't probably seen at Inishowen, or, you know, the Bear Peninsula, or, you know, or anywhere else, because he hasn't really had a chance to get out. There's been no football, so it's a chance for him tomorrow. He's going to have to sort of, you know, let people know where he's coming from, why he is doing what he's doing, and why this MOU must be passed for the good of Irish football. I think it's time that Roy stood up and let people know exactly where he's coming from and what he wants for Irish football, because he's a very key player in all this. He was the guy who did the deal with Shane Ross, and he's the guy who has to stand over this. And really, Irish football needs this money. We cannot... I wouldn't like to see something like this will happen, where someone someone's head is called for tomorrow, and there's, oh yeah, we've got a result here, we've got blood on the carpet, but then the cheque still isn't signed, and there's nothing for Irish football. And as you say, the government may well decide, you know what, lads, we did our very best, you can't sort the mess out, we're walking away from this. And where would that leave Irish football? It would just knock it back into the dark ages.
Yeah, like, I can understand where some of the directors and some of the council members are somewhat frustrated, given that when this memorandum came around, there were small changes made to the agreements that were kind of there in what was effectively a reform document that was put together. They made those kind of slight changes. Things were agreed at a time where it looked like it was a really dark hour for the FAI, and the tap of money needed to be turned on. And similarly, I can understand why the football family wouldn't want a situation where there's six independent directors and six directors of their own from inside the football family, to use that phrase. But I just kind of think, with the greater picture here, there's probably not going to be a huge amount of sympathy from the public, or maybe even some within the football family, out of the position that's being taken here.
Well, I'll give the football family a break here, because if you look at the composition of the board, at the moment it's 8 versus 4. So that's 8 football people, 4 non-football people. So, you know, you talk about sovereignty, which is a big issue. UEFA and FIFA say, you know, football people have to have the final say in the membership of their inner sanctum, as it were. You look at other sports in Ireland: athletics, 2 out of 16 independents; gymnastics, 2 out of 9; swimming, 2 out of 11; boxing, 3 out of 10; cricket, 5 out of 12. The GA have a management committee. None of their 16 are outsiders. English FA, 2 out of 10. Now, we're looking at going 6-6, so those numbers are completely against other sports and other sporting associations. And I think that's a point that, you know, the members of the board and the council members who've called this meeting tomorrow, that's why they're fearful. That's why they're a little bit frightened about, you know, losing the autonomy, the right to govern the association that they are part of. And that shouldn't be taken away from them. That's a very cogent and a very persuasive argument.
And the argument will be made that if the sovereignty is taken away, even in these dark times, it's very difficult to actually claw that back.
It would be difficult, yeah. You could say, look, you know what, let's give 6v6 a go and see what happens in a couple of years' time. But I think there has to be wriggle room. And I think Gary Owens, the CEO, hinted at that yesterday. He kind of threw an olive branch where he said, look, it's very easy to switch the final casting vote from the chairman, Mr. Barrett, to the president, Mr. McEnany, and leave it like that. And that can be done at an AGM. And that's not difficult to do. And also there's a way around, there's a new electoral reform process to decide which people are fit and proper to serve on council. So it's not a question of the 27, 28 guys and women being culled if you've got 10 years service. So look, there has to be a bit of give and take here. You know, we don't want blood on the carpet. We had it in the Westbury 24 years ago? And here we are in the red cow, you know, the colour red, blood. I hope it's not a metaphor for what might happen tomorrow. I hope there's common sense. I hope there's a bit of leeway and a bit of recognition as well. For the volunteers who do so much to keep Irish football on the road. And, you know, Niall Quinn talks about unity, and Niall has put a lot of work into this. He's been on a lot of committees. I think he's been on too many committees. Mm-hmm. He mentioned unity this week. We need unity. What I'm hearing from the football people who are on the opposite side of the pitch to Niall, they're saying what Niall has done, he has brought unity. He's got people unified against, you know, to him and Gary Owens to a certain degree, and those on the board who are not listening to the football side, if you like. Now they need to listen. They need to all sit. I can't understand why they can't sit down and have a pot of tea and thrash it out. And you know, that's what chairmen do. And this is a big challenge for Roy Barrett. Chairmen bring people with them. They don't push them away. And I think the message when he goes to the Red Cow tomorrow, there are people looking for him to bring them together. And if he pushes them away, then they could react and there could be a revolt. And I think that would be a disaster for Irish football.
Yeah, because in many ways, Roy Barrett probably has to put himself front and centre, because in some ways for this interim regime that have come in, Niall Quinn has been the public face.
Yeah, Niall has been pushed out there because, for obvious reasons, international, Sunderland, chairman, you know, he's done it all. And I think he has tried very hard to right the ship. He spoke today about propaganda earlier on television. I think that's a little bit unfair, you know. People have their views, and I think he has to accept that. And I know he had difficulties trying to get his head around the League of Ireland clubs and you know, in terms of coming back and how much money they were going to need and behind closed doors and COVID-19 testing and all that. There was a lot going on in the streaming. There was a lot of stuff going on there. But he was the visible presence. And a lot of people I've spoken to are not convinced that Niall has done a great job. I don't agree with that. I think he actually... Niall can open any room. He can get a key. He can open any door. And he's a good people person. But the FAI is a different, it's a tricky animal to get your head around, you know, and get in touch. And you've got Niall, the visible presence. Gary Owens has done a few phone calls, but he's been fairly quiet, media-wise, until yesterday. Roy, we haven't seen an awful lot of Roy Barrett. And he's the man behind the scenes. He's going to be there tomorrow in the Red Cow. And I think he has to be very persuasive and very convincing that, you know, his way is the right way. But there has to be some leeway as well to appease those who send blood and who sent that all is not well at the way the FAI is run. And look, also, we have a couple of other things very quickly, Will. You know, Gary Owens is an interim CEO. We need a permanent CEO, Irish football. That has to be decided. We need that quickly. Niall Quinn is kind of finished as deputy interim CEO. He said yesterday he'd stay on until August 31st. What happens after that? Well, he was very non-committal. Well, to me, he should have said, I'm either going or I'm staying, one or the other. We don't need uncertainty. We've had too much uncertainty in Irish football. You know, we're nearly 17 months since the Sunday Times broke the story about the 100,000 payment by John Delaney. And, you know, Irish football has been all about non-football events basically ever since. It's time to move on.
I'd imagine a lot gets aired tomorrow at that meeting. And again, conversations, as you said, can be very important to actually take place. And they're almost as well off to try and get everything out in the air, at least to start tomorrow. It still leaves them with a couple of weeks to try and find some kind of consensus after tomorrow. I mean, ultimately, the real looming date here is the EGM by the end of the month.
Yeah, that's where they have to decide to accept the terms of the MOU. They don't actually vote on them. They just accept them. But if they accept them, that'll be enough. That'll be enough for cheques to be written from the government to Sport Ireland and free up a lot of money. Also, the FAI put in for $10.4 million from the COVID relief fund from the government. And Irish football needs this money. You know, there's nothing going into it at the moment. There's no air being pumped into the football. The international team is going to play in September in front of nobody at the Aviva Stadium, and possibly again in October and maybe again in November. Who knows when there'll be crowds at Croke Park or the Aviva for big matches. So it needs government support and it needs UEFA support. It's already got some support from the Bank of Ireland in terms of finance, but that's not going to last forever. And I think common sense will prevail, but there has to be a little bit of give, and you know, give from the, how do you say, from from the inner sanctum. And the inner sanctum is the board of the FAI. That board is split. It needs to be unified. Roy Barrett is chairman. It's his job to bring it together. And if he can do so, and they all agree, then I think we have a way out of this. But if 6-6 remains, and with Roy as the casting vote, that is going to cause untold difficulties. And it's not too difficult to resolve.
In terms of trying to maybe win the hearts and minds of those who are dissenting or pushing against the new board currently, the fact that a letter came from UEFA and FIFA to say that they would back the reforms and even back the independent directors coming in, is that likely to hold any sway at all?
I think it helps the case for Roy and the independents on the board. Yeah, to have the two world governing body and the European governing body. I think they just want this sorted out. I think they just, come on, let's just get on with it, you know. We've done our bit, we've helped you out, we can help you out again. But it still doesn't resolve the issue of potentially non-footballing people having the final say in the association. And as I said to you, I listed off 5 or 6 other sports where that would not be entertained. It would not be entertained. And, you know, there is an argument that the FAI, you know, for 90 years... you know, didn't really do their job very well. I think that's being a little bit harsh because it wasn't always doom and gloom. It wasn't always badly run. But, you know, I think the football people can't be marginalised. They can't be put into the shadows because there are good people on the board. The people on the board now are not the people who were on the board when John Delaney was in charge. Let's not forget that. These are bright, intelligent people from very strong backgrounds, high up positions in Dublin authorities, in broadcasting, in professional jobs, accountants, all bright people, professional businessmen and professional businesswomen. And they weren't on the board when Delaney was there because he was surrounded by people who just basically nodded and didn't ask any questions. These are people who should be trusted and can be trusted. Because some of them were asking questions of Delaney a few years ago, particularly Paul Cook, the vice president, and he was immediately marginalised. You know, he has a lot to offer, and so do others on the board. So it's not like you can say that, well, the board of the FAI, so they've made a mess of it for years. This board is different. This board is new, it's bright, it's shiny, and it's got ideas, and it needs to work with the independents. But it needs to be, I think it needs to be given the right to have the final say. And at the moment, as things stand in the small print of the MOU, it doesn't have the final say, and that's a big, big problem.
Philip, before I let you go, I'll let you back to the golf because I'm sure you're intrigued what's happening at the moment in San Francisco. But Shane Lowry making a very good start, 2 under par, 68, three shots behind the clubhouse leader Jason Day as things stand. That's a very good start for a man chasing successive majors.
It is. He said yesterday how important it was to have Beau Martin back on the bag. Hadn't had him since March. His caddy, who only came on board in the last 2 years and was there with him, of course, for Royal Port Rush success last year. And Shane only needs a little flick. He's one of those guys who, he's a sleeper. He'll do nothing for 4 or 5 events, and suddenly, he'll have a good one. And he kicked a good one in last week with a top 6. He said if everybody brings their A game this week, you know, it's going to be very hard for him. But 2 under par is a good start. I mean, I watched a few hours of there tonight, Will, and there's no wind. It's the early morning. It's, you know, the greens were soft. It was a putting competition. It'll be different in the afternoon tomorrow when he plays. It'll be firmer greens, crusty greens. The wind will get up. It's a good start. And we all want to see Shane Lowry do well. Winning back-to-back majors, that is so difficult to do. But, yeah, it's hard to believe it's 13 months since the last major took place. And he really hasn't had a good run. He'd love to be announced onto the first tee, you know, as major champion with a whole crowd. Or the Irish Open, you know, same thing, and the Open at Royal St. George's. So I feel a bit for Shane because he's going to play the USPGA, and then we have the US Open, and we have the US Masters in November, and there's going to be no real fanfare around him. I can't see crowds at any of those events. But look, it's the same for everybody, and he's made a good start. He's turned into a little bit of form. He'll need to go 3 rounds in the 60s again to have any contention. I think the winning score here, it could be, you know, he's 4 rounds in the 60s last week, Will. He's going to need 4 rounds again, and he's going to have to keep holding everything because this is going to be a putting fest come the weekend.
Well, enjoy watching the late starters and looking forward to getting off air to watch a bit of the golf myself. Philip, thanks a million for joining us on the show.
Thanks, Will.
Okay, latest in the Europa League, it is still Wolves 1, Olympiacos 0. That is coming up on the hour. We'll be talking to Kenny Cunningham after the break.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. We love the beautiful game more than Olivia Giroud loves the near post.
Gamble responsibly. CWE.net.
The sound of the Champions League theme. It is back for what's going to be a very unusual end to the tournament. We've still got four round of 16 second legs to be completed this weekend. But then next week, we get into the quarterfinals of Europe's Premier Club competition, and it will all be played in Portugal. The Europa League comes to a conclusion over the next few weeks too. We're getting into the last eight of the competition, the remaining last 16 ties being completed this evening, ahead of the quarterfinals getting underway on Monday, with Manchester United going up against FC Copenhagen. Latest at Molineux, it is 1-0 to Wolves against Olympiacos. As things stand, Wolves will progress 2-1 in aggregate. Basel still 0-0 against Eintracht Frankfurt. Basel 3-0 up from the first leg. Sevilla have qualified for the last eight with a 2-0 victory against Roma. And Bayer Leverkusen have beaten Rangers 1-0 to progress 4-1 in aggregate into the quarterfinals of the competition. So as things stand, Wolves could still play Manchester United. Champions League to look forward to too, including a big game tomorrow night. You've got the champions of Spain are in England to take on Man City in the second leg. The first leg was played back in February, and City are 2-1 up against Real Madrid. Joining us to look forward to all the football over the next while is former Republic of Ireland captain Kenny Cunningham. Kenny, good evening to you.
Evening, Will.
How are you now, Kenny? Looking forward to this massive amount of football that's going to come in a very quick period of time. We didn't get much of a break with the FA Cup final a few days off, and here we are now with Europe over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's true, but I can't wait, Will, to be honest with you. Ever since this kind of format was announced for the Champions League knockout stages some time ago, I think straight away everybody thought, wow, this is going to be pretty special, getting the group of teams together, albeit we'll have to wait another week for that in a condensed period of time. And those one-off games, knockout games from the quarterfinal onwards, it's going to be pretty unique. We might as well just enjoy it because we may well never see it again in this type of format.
It changes things quite a bit as well, Kenny, because usually we get used to these two-legged affairs for the quarterfinals and the semi-finals, eventually getting to a final. That brings its own tactical side of things with away goals and having your own support in front of you. We're now looking at empty stadiums in Lisbon, one-off games, and teams playing in pretty quick succession. It's a Champions League like no other, really.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's pretty unique. It'll be fascinating from the tackle point of view to a certain extent, Will. I think I won't be that surprised though, in terms of how it plays out. I think modern football, and you look at the majority of those teams who'll be left in the competition, Will, and obviously Manchester City and Chelsea, Bournemouth, are still ties to be decided. But the modern way, really, in terms of the top sides, it's a possession-based game. Teams want to get on the front foot. They want to dominate. They want to be progressive. They want to throw players into advanced areas of the pitch, overcommit at times, create opportunities. This is the kind of philosophy, mindset, whatever you want to call it, of a lot of the top managers and football in general. So I think you see a lot of that anyway, Will, even if it was a two-legged format. I still think managers are still kind of very positive, even away from home. The old days, you know, of turning up at the away leg and shutting up shop, you know, maybe pinching away goal, but just sitting on the edge of your penalty box, is pretty much gone. A part of your Atletico Madrid, that is probably the one exception. But I think this one-off format, if anything, probably enhances that even more so. I think we'll see the majority of these teams, whoever they are, really kind of go for it and go at each other. That's the way modern teams really play. And with the amount of attacking quality in the ranks of those teams, absolutely packed, you know, from the likes of potentially Real Madrid and Man City, which we'll see tomorrow evening, even down to the likes of Atlanta, probably my dark horses for the competition. Some wonderful attacking players, and a lot of the modern-day managers now are giving these players freedom to get on the ball and go and play and affect the game. And that's what we're seeing a lot more of.
Yeah, it's very interesting setup as well, as you mentioned. Atalanta, PSG, Atletico Madrid on one side, and they've got a lot of the big hitters, Real Madrid, Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Juventus, all on one side. So potentially you could have a first-time finalist on the other side of the draw. You mentioned Man City against Real Madrid, Kenny. We've go back a long time to go back to the first leg. It was on in late February. That Kevin De Bruyne show at the Bernabeu set up one goal, then scored the winner to give City a very good position going into this second leg. Real Madrid without Sergio Ramos as well. It seems to be reasonably well set up for City to progress, albeit they don't have Sergio Aguero for this one.
No, they don't. Yeah, he surprised us a little bit, Will. That first leg seemed so long ago. I'm glad you told me what score it was. I'd almost forgotten up until today. It was that long ago. But yeah, tactically, he kind of threw a bit of a curveball in, didn't he? He kind of played Kevin De Bruyne, as I remember, as a number 10. And I think Bernardo Silva played up there as a kind of a false nine. Jesus, I remember, occupying the left flank, and was hailed as a bit of a genius stroke on the night, which, you know, when you go on to win the game, fair enough. I wasn't bowled over by it personally, myself, well, Jesus for me is a natural number nine. He's at his best when he's operating between the two centre halves and off the shoulders at a centre half. So I don't think we'll see that format tomorrow night from Guardiola. I think we'll see them revert to the more traditional 4-3-3 with Jesus high up the pitch and Raheem Sterling and possibly Mahrez off the right hand side, and then he'll just have his decisions to make in that midfield three, which personnel to choose. So I think it'd be more of the traditional Manchester City kind of style of play and tactical setup that we're used to, and clearly they're very comfortable with.
I would imagine too that decision that has to be made around Kevin De Bruyne. I think Guardiola would have to look back at the Chelsea game a few weeks ago where he put De Bruyne in as a false nine. He wasn't able to influence the game in the same way that he's able to do when he's further back. De Bruyne said himself he prefers to play as a central midfielder where he can kind of dictate where he moves in the midfield. I think he'll lose a lot of Kevin De Bruyne's game if you put him further forward.
Yeah, absolutely, Will. I agree with you. Player of his quality, you need to get him in areas of the pitch where he can consistently get on the ball and influence the game. And even playing as a false number nine, somebody who kind of drops off into the space, you know, you're still dependent on other people feeding you the ball into your feet to get yourself into the game. When he plays his more traditional kind of number eight position, him and whoever it'll be, it might be Silva tomorrow night, possibly Gundogan, he can still drift into an orthodox midfield position, receive the ball a little bit deeper, and then see that range of passing which he has. You know, he can pop the ball quickly, you know, 10, 15 yards and break the lines. He can play those wingers in behind, those big diagonal switches. He has it all. He can travel with the ball himself, get shots off on his left and right foot. So I agree with you. For me, he's actually wasted as a withdrawn number nine. That number 10 role, I think there's an argument for that. But for me, he's best when he's facing the play in that slightly deeper position. And that kind of 4-3-3 formation, that V-shaped in midfield that Man City plays, they give him a bit of license. He's not too disciplined and that rigid in that system where he has to stay in advanced areas high up the pitch. He has the freedom to drop in deep into little pockets and really go and affect the game as he sees fit. I think Guardiola trusts him. He knows the qualities that he has. So I think you're right. I think it'd be a mistake and I think it'd be wasted to play as a false number nine tomorrow evening. I don't think we'll see it.
City's form was pretty decent after lockdown. You could argue that maybe the foot was off the pedal for some of the teams around them when they played them. But you can't get away from the fact, Kenny, they've lost 11 games in all competitions this season, which is massively up on the year before. They are conceding quite a few goals, Wayne Rooney pointing out in his column last weekend, particularly against the top six in England, and they were given huge problems by Wolves. So every kind of big game that City have played this season, they've really struggled to keep clean sheets. And under Guardiola in the Champions League, they've only kept two clean sheets in the knockout games that they've played. That has to give a bit of hope to Real Madrid, because they're going to have to score at least twice tomorrow night.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, it's no coincidence the top teams, because top teams have the best players. And you have any kind of weakness in your team, it gets exposed at the highest level. There's no higher level than the knockout stages of the Champions League and the better teams, the Premiership that you're talking about, Will. We know where the deficiencies are in that Manchester City team, the centre in that defence. It wouldn't surprise me if Fernandinho drops in there. It's not ideal putting him in there, but I think he's probably the best option to play alongside Laporte. His experience, he's so dependable. He has that kind of defensive mindset. You'd really want to split him in two, to be honest with you, and play him in both of those positions, centre-half and hold the midfield for me. But obviously got the option of Rodri there. So he may well drop Fernandinho. I trust him ahead of Otamendi all day of the week. And it doesn't look as if the young boy Garcia is going to get the nod either. So that's probably the way to go. But I don't think it's just as simple as that, Will, in terms of that deficiency in the centre defence. We've all known about that. For me, Manchester City, the intensity hasn't been there since the start of the season in terms of that press, particularly the kind of counter press once they lose the ball. City at their very best a couple of years ago. They were hungry out of possession, Will. You know, they were kind of, you know, they were ravenous. They hunted in packs when they lost the ball. When they're in possession, they give it away. Immediately, that counter press came within 1-2 seconds, and the opposition team almost invariably gave it back to them. They've been a little bit more passive this year, physically a little bit more of a drop off, certainly the first half of the season. So a combination of all those little things for me are the reasons why we're seeing the kind of numbers that you've spoken about. So yeah, no, they have to improve. The intensity has to be better. And they need to find a solution in the centre of that defence. It's going to have to be a collective solution as well. It means Kyle Walker not just raiding down that right hand side with no kind of obligation to drop back in alongside his centre half. He's going to have to pick and choose his moments when to get forward and keep his defensive discipline at times as well. So they need to rectify that, but they're an experienced enough group now to understand what's required to get over this hurdle of Real Madrid tomorrow evening.
What do you make of this Gareth Bale situation, Kenny, given 2 years ago now, 2018, he comes on against Liverpool, scores two goals, including that cracking bicycle kick, one of the best goals ever in the competition's history, to help them win the European Cup. And here we are, 2 years later, he's refused to travel with Real Madrid, he's looking for a transfer away, and he won't be part of the squad tomorrow night. Quite the fall from grace, isn't it?
It is, but it's been coming for quite some time, Will, in all honesty. I mean, if you look at it purely his game since kind of post-lockdown, he hasn't really been involved. The injuries have been involved in a couple of games, so there's not really an argument there in terms of Gareth Bale starting. Pest possibly could make an argument, get him on the bench. He's a big match player. He's kind of proven that, but obviously things have been right for quite some time. His relationship with the club, with the manager, you know, all kinds of questions and kind of murmuring. So I don't think it's a huge surprise. I mean, he's remained pretty silent, to be honest, which probably his agent's done more speaking than the player during that period. But I don't think that'll surprise anybody. And to be honest with you, I don't think it's going to be a massive loss for Zidane. He's got some good options now in that area of the pitch, which Gale kind of Bale operates. Albeit it looks as if Hazard may get the start in Asensio tomorrow evening, but they've had their injury problems as well. So he'll be taking a certain gamble even with those two players in terms of injuries if he chooses to play them from the start. I think there's the argument there where Bale put him on the bench. Maybe that could have impact last 10, 15 minutes of the game. If you needed it, maybe a bit of inspiration. But it looks as if that relationship has broken down, Will. And to be honest with you, that looks as if it's been the case for quite some time. So no real surprise when I hear that news.
Chelsea have to pick themselves up tomorrow night, Kenny, after losing the FA Cup final against Arsenal. They go to Bayern Munich this weekend, 3-0 down from the first leg. Serge Gnabry getting a couple, Robert Lewandowski getting the other at Stamford Bridge, which pretty much killed that tie. Given that Bayern Munich have pretty much had a 100% record since lockdown, given how impressive they've been and how good they are at this stage of the Champions League, we can't really give Chelsea any hope of beating them by four goals tomorrow or on Saturday night.
No, little or no hope. You'd always make the argument, Will, on any given day. We've all seen anything's possible in a game of football. You could certainly make an argument in terms of the team that Chelsea put on the pitch. Got some wonderful players, particularly in attacking areas of the pitch. But those kind of frailties which they've had defensively over the course of the year, spoken about Manchester City, but Chelsea, it's been the same. Conceded too many goals on occasions. And this Bayern Munich team, again, at the highest level, Will, you get exposed, and they've been playing really well. I've seen a lot of them play since the lockdown. They're absolutely breathtaking at times. So much ferocious pace, Will, in the team, particularly in kind of wide areas. I'm guessing Gnabry's going to play, possibly Coman the other side, even that kind of central midfield area. They've got some great options there. Goretzka's looking a real player. Those kind of third man runs from midfield into the box, he's getting his fair share of goals. Muller's had a second lease of life there as well. But you could go on and on. I like the defensive line. I like the look of Pavard. I'm a big fan of Alphonso Davies. He's done magnificently well at left back. Going forward, there's probably nobody better, Will. I think even defensively he's getting better. He's improving. The more time he spends in that orthodox kind of left back position, Alaba inside him is a wonderful player. Boateng probably is the only one he might actually play. For me, it gives Chelsea a little bit of hope. I'm not as big as fan. I think there's question marks about kind of his mobility, you know, his quickness on the turn, but just don't know whether Chelsea are even going to wrestle enough possession of the ball, because Bayern Munich keep it. I mean, they're devastating on the counter-attack, Will, because of the pace that I've mentioned there that they have, particularly in wide areas, but they can dominate the ball as well. Kimmich in that kind of holding position, which he usually is in central midfield. They could well throw Thiago in there as well. And if they do, them two, they just keep the ball between them like for the majority of the game. So it's a huge ask for Chelsea. I'm a big fan of Lampard and what he's done this season at Chelsea, but I really give him very little, if no chance, of turning that around.
When it comes to turning around their defensive issues, and they've had problems at set pieces, problems with pace, problems with organisation at the back, is it purely down to the personnel, Kenny, in terms of does Frank Lampard need to go and now shop in his defence, given he's already spent a lot of attacking money for next year? Or is this down to maybe getting a good defensive coach in for next season? Are the players there good enough to be a solid defence for Chelsea, or do they need recruitment?
Now, it's an interesting point, Will. You don't hear that actually, I'm going to pay a compliment here, you don't hear it made too often in terms of, you know, it's easy to say, well, he's not good enough, individual mistakes, that's not good enough from that player in a fullback or a centre. back position. He needs to improve. But people never question in terms of the amount of time that managers actually commit to the defensive side of the game. You hear a lot of stories now, you know, managers reluctant to put in that amount of time on the defensive side of the game. I almost think it's too negative, you know, implanting negative thoughts in the player's mind. What are we always thinking about defending, Gaff? We should be on the attack, be more positive. I think that's kind of an interesting conversation, which you don't hear too often. I suppose the answer to that, Will, is I don't know. I don't know how much work goes on the training pitch in terms of the defensive setup of the team. But from what I see week in, week out, again, what I've seen at Chelsea, I don't think he's got a natural pair in there at centre-half. He's got some great options there, a bit like Manchester United. 4, 5, 6 options, players who can play at centre-half. But for me, there's not a natural pair in there. Even probably Rudiger, who maybe 5, 6 months ago you thought, yeah, you'd hang your hat on him, get a good one to play alongside him. Even now you're looking at Rudiger, he's taken him out of the team. Lambert's had to take him out of the team. He's a little bit off colour. So, so putting aside that in terms of the collective organisation of the team, I think they need at least one dominant centre-half in there. I definitely think they're short. I think they could clear the decks of maybe 2 or 3 and get a top-class centre-half. We're probably going to see one over the next couple of days in the Napoli shirt, going to the Nou Camp to play Barcelona and Koulibaly. Another top-class performance from him. He's been highly consistent, really, for the past couple of seasons. No surprise there. He's probably the best 2-3 centre-halves in the world and has been for some time. So it'll be interesting to see. I think that Chelsea now are in the position to bid for a player of that calibre, as are the likes of Manchester United and even Manchester City. I think that type of person who really, you can't pick apart defensively, solid, physically strong, aggressive, good in 1v1 situations, decent read of the game, competent in possession, Will, which sometimes isn't enough for some managers, I feel. Even the likes of Frank Lampard, I look at him and think, is he happy? Is he going to be happy with a centre-half who wins headers, wins tackles, senses danger, organises people? But you know what? He might be a little bit clunky on the ball. He mightn't have the ability to step into midfield and break the lines with his passing. You mean, is that going to hold them back? I'd like to think that, but that's how the game's obviously changed over the past couple of years. But for me, it's the exact type of centre-half that Chelsea need. Not only Chelsea, a number of teams. I could argue Manchester United, Tottenham and Manchester City. That type of centre-half who really, from a defensive point of view, you can pick apart. He may not be the best ball-playing centre-half in the world, but you know what? I'll always suffer that. When I look at recruiting a top-class centre-half, I always look at the basics that I've spoken about there in terms of defensive qualities which he have. I just don't see enough of that in some of the centre-halves operating at the top level now.
Well, one of the players that gave Chelsea's defence lots of trouble last weekend was Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang in that FA Cup final. Sumptuous chip to win the game for Arsenal. It looks, at least if the Telegraph are to be believed tonight, that Arsenal now have an agreement with him on a 3-year contract. He's going to cost them a lot of money, Kenny. He's 31 years of age, so his decline is probably inevitable in the coming seasons. But was there an inevitability about the fact that Arsenal had to pay him to keep him around?
No, I think there was inevitability that they had to push as far as they could. I never agree with the statement, I'll give him what he wants. I mean, that's what got him into the problems that they have in terms of giving Ozil the amount of money that he wanted. Arsene Wenger obviously gave the board the green light. He wanted Ozil to stay, and he gave them the green light to give Ozil that massive wage. And for me, it was kind of counterproductive. It's actually caused them some problems. It's the reason why Aaron Ramsey left the football club, because he wanted parity with Ozil, didn't get it, and off he went. And again, for me, it's a lingering problem with Aubameyang, looking at Ozil not making any contribution whatsoever to the team, earning $350. No wonder his agent's banging on the door saying, well, we need parity with this player, the contribution my player's making. How can you make an argument he's not entitled to a wage similar to what Ozil's on? So that's the problems that you create for yourself. Manchester United did the same with Sanchez. Huge mistake taking him into the football club and paying him that type of wage. Very quickly, everybody else, particularly the players of a similar level, are looking for parity with that wage, and other players are looking to be brought up accordingly as well. But I always felt they'd push as far as they could, Arsenal. It looks as if they've done that. And I'm actually pleased, to be honest with you. Aubameyang looks like a player, his body language, that he's really enjoying his football. I think it's a good stage from their great football club, Arsenal. No guarantee of Champions League football going forward. That's the gamble that he's taken. He's got to back himself and his teammates to bring Champions League football back to Arsenal the next couple of years. But he could be instrumental for Arsenal, those younger players, their development. He's kind of a beacon for those younger players in terms of how he plays. Very inspirational in terms of his attacking qualities. And you mentioned kind of his age. Will, I think you have to take everyone in his merits. 31 years of age, normally you'd say he's at his peak, he's just over, his legs are going to be shot in 3 years. Not always the case. I think Willian at Chelsea is a great example of that. I think these lads, I look at their kind of physical makeup, albeit I'm looking from a distance, and I think these lads are real athletes. They're kind of thoroughbreds. You know, you look at the likes of Ronaldo, what he's doing at his age, and a number of other players. Their physical condition nowadays is absolutely phenomenal. So he might be able to extend in terms of his quality performance at Aubameyang for the next 2 or 3 years. That's where Arsenal will be banking on. And if he can maintain that level of performance during the length of that contract, well, then those wages will be money well spent.
Well, Kenny, before I let you go, I'm told your former club, Talca Rovers, have set up a GoFundMe page. They've run into a bit of financial bother because of COVID-19 restrictions. The club bar has had to close, which means they've lost out on a bit of revenue, and they're now trying to raise €40,000. You can get the details on our Twitter. That's twitter.com/offtheball. We've got a link to the GoFundMe there as well. Kenny, they reliably tell me when you were at the club, you were too young to drink, and you would have been a teetotaler anyway.
Yeah, my dad put a bit of money behind the bar, though. I will say that. So the Cunningham family, indirectly, say, would have made a contribution over the years. Probably put a few quid in the slots on the snooker table. But I'm sorry to hear that. I really enjoyed it. I only had a year up in Talca Rovers, Griffith Avenue Extension, but I loved it. I had a wonderful facility there, the pitch, and obviously the bar area that you're talking about. So, yeah, you know, I'm not one for jumping on the internet and searching out these things, but I'll make an exception in Talca Rovers case.
Look, fingers crossed they can raise a few quid. Kenny, enjoy the football over the weekend. Thanks a million for joining us tonight.
Cheers, Will. Anytime.
Latest score in the Europa League. Wolves are still ahead, about 2 minutes of normal time left, 1-0 up against Olympiacos. As things stand, they'll qualify for the quarterfinals. Basel already through against their win against Frankfurt. Bayer Leverkusen beating Rangers earlier tonight. We'll take a break.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. As potent as Rashford and Fernandes post lockdown.
Gamble responsibly. CWE.net.
The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.